let me remind you in case you've forgotten. Today is an anniversary day. 24 years ago, Mr. Armstrong died. 24 years ago. And when you look at it, you know, it's 212 cycles, if you will. And 12 means governmental perfection. I thought that's very interesting. So, you know, as the new calendar year begins, events are rapidly accelerating. And yet our Western societies are unaware, completely unaware, it seems, at least for the 99.99% of people are unaware, of the serious events that must shortly come to pass. What I want to do this morning is look at some prophecies that were spoken of so many years ago, that are literally unfolding before our very eyes. And you're going to see that as we go through some of this information I have. And, you know, perhaps you can think back when Mr. Armstrong made certain predictions. And people in the past looked upon things that he was saying as being absolutely outrageous statements of his various predictions. Outrageous, how could he say that? You know, this sort of thing. Perhaps many within the churches of God feel that way today. I know some do. He's minimized, ridiculed, and marginalized by so many. Yet, as I said to one person, do we minimize, do we ridicule, do we marginalize the Apostle John or the Apostle Paul? And the answer invariably is no, we don't. Then why Mr. Armstrong? You know, interesting. I heard about a situation that occurred with another group, I was being told. A young man, not sure the country, and studying his Bible. A young person, I mean someone in their 20s, studying his Bible, and it came, it kind of dawned on him that it's important we keep the Sabbath day. And so he went to the computer, he Googled the Sabbath, and what do you think came up? Whose name was prominent? Mr. Armstrong. So he read all kinds of booklets, listened to some of the audios, and so I thought, well, that's very interesting. You see, his writings are still teaching. How can you ridicule, minimize, and marginalize them after 24 years? You know, none of his predictions were more provocative than those surrounding the formation of the United States of Europe, Germany as its leader, and the Catholic Church that would glue it all together. Now, there is a trinity for you, if there ever was one. The title really of the sermon, if you want to thought about this last night, what could the title be? The U.S. of Europe equals Germany and the Vatican. Because in essence, that's what it comes down to. And we're going to see that as we go through here. Those are the areas that we want to concentrate on here this morning. And you know, I sometimes have to wonder if people really grasp the significance of what is happening. And I was talking to an individual last night I've known for many, many years. And he doesn't get the fact of the A, the times, B, the significance of what happened, the prophecies that were given, the influence that Mr. Armstrong had. Yet people say we worship him. No, we don't. No, we don't. We don't worship the Apostle Paul. But their writings and teachings live on. That's the point. And I know that many within some of the churches have no idea what's going on. And they're going to get caught off guard. In early December 2009, just a few short weeks ago now, maybe it's close to a month now, I was reading a monthly business journal newspaper. It's a small publication. And it circulated in one of the largest Toronto suburbs. And a headline in the opinion section caught my eye immediately, and it would catch yours too if you saw it. I opened up, there's the opinions, and there's the number of different writers. And the article said, "The Advent of the United States of Europe." Now, you talk about provocative. I said, "What?" So I immediately started to read the article, and I'm going to read it to you. And the author's name is Dr. Bikram Lamba. He's a Sikh by birth and by religion. And he's a political and a business strategist located in Toronto. Very intelligent man. After reading the article, I called him. I was really anxious just to find a little bit more about what he was researching, what he found out. And he asked me, you know, what I knew. So I told him. I said it was prophesied. He said it was. So I went through a few things with him, mentioned Mr. Armstrong. And he was very interested. In fact, he asked me if I would send my comments to his editor, which I did. So they're all coming to the feast this year. No, they're not. No, they're not. Only teasing. Listen to what he writes. And remember, nothing like this has been seen in the press in the West at all that I'm aware of. Never. And I read a lot. Nothing. This man, look what he came up with. He says, during my recent lecture tour of Europe, I was struck by the widespread perception that the United States of America has to vacate its position of being a superpower to the United States of Europe in the very near future. This is more than a wishful thought. The celebrations of the fall of the infamous Berlin Wall and subsequent unification of Germany, leading to establishment of the EU and approval of the Lisbon Treaty, are fueling this belief. Apart from the global perception of a weakening U.S. and Anglo-Saxon power, the threat from Russia makes one wonder whether the position of Europe as a single political entity is a distant dream. One of the main reasons the European Union is overlooked as a future superpower is the perceived inability of European nations to subordinate their national interest to a strong central government in Brussels. One comment that was made said, today there is one challenge to the dominance of the U.S. economy, the European Union. But the unwieldy conglomeration of 27 or even 16 states cannot be a strategic player. This was written in the well-respected Foreign Affairs Journal back in October. It is typical of what is written about the EU, that it is a potential superpower, but it will never fully unite because there is no one single nation that can get everybody on board. However, when I was talking to the people in Europe, in the European Parliament in Brussels, I was given to understand, albeit obliquely, the exact opposite will happen. Soon the European Union will become the greatest strategic player in the world with a strong central government led by Germany. All the proponents of this theory quote America's own history to prove its probability. And here's how he put it together. He said, from the revolution until the Constitution was ratified, the United States wasn't as united as the name implied. Its federal government was weak under the Articles of Confederation, lacking in executive to enforce laws, and not even possessing the ability to tax its citizens. Citizens did not identify themselves as Americans yet. They saw their own state as the nation. And these weaknesses led to two main problems that are a driving force behind the creation of a strong federal government: financial instability and lack of security. What does that remind you of today? Exactly what they say in Europe. Exactly the same thing. He goes on to say in the article, the debate for a stronger federal union took on greater impetus when James Madison and George Washington helped resolve a financial trade dispute between Maryland and Virginia outside of Congress. This circumvented the federal government and was outside normal bounds. And he goes on and talks about the different things that took place within the states, trying to get them together, trying to make compromises and accommodate what the states wanted, but still bringing together this government that had significance and could have and would have significance. So he says, in addition to the various changes, the promise of a future Bill of Rights to protect citizens was needed to convince those states to ratify the Constitution, especially North Carolina and Rhode Island, which eventually did in the following 2 years. Even then, if it wasn't for the general assumption that George Washington was to be the first president and prevent any abuse of power, the ratification still might not have happened. The Constitution, that noble and extraordinary document, was only ratified after a harrowing struggle. Its creation was driven by financial instability and the lack of security, and it needed the rigorous leadership of the founding fathers to get it passed. And now history is merely repeating itself. When analysts overlook Europe's potential superpower, they overlook the fact that the same driving forces that helped unite America are present in Europe. The financial meltdown has destabilized Europe's financial system, and Europe faces a security threat from Islamic terrorists within its own borders. In fact, Germany, which is one of the dominant powers, is very concerned about that in terms of the future. So this is the exact same thing that happened in the formation of the United States is what's taking place in Europe. So it is exactly the same identical logic and argument that led Alexander Hamilton to propose a stronger federal government 8 years before it finally happened. The financial crisis has presented European leaders with one of the biggest opportunities yet to unify Europe under a strong central government. Then he goes on and talks about the financial crisis and how that's going to get addressed. And he says, there's no denying the fact that Europe is different. It has to be accepted that the nature of these two nations is vastly different. Yes, the founding fathers were willing to work outside normal legal bounds. They worked in secrecy, and they settled for a ratification method that wasn't purely democratic. However, all states, north and south, believed in representative government, the rule of law, and the rights of free speech, right of assembly, and of religion. The Constitution upheld all these democratic principles and rights, which were soon spelled out in the first 10 amendments. The ratification conventions may not have been a direct referendum, but the debates were published and open, and everyone knew what was going on. European ratification, he says, by contrast, has operated in a much more deceptive way and on principles far different from the British tradition that early America was built on. The Europe project is built on the tradition of the bloody dictatorship of Charlemagne with the Catholic Church, the glue to hold it together. What a statement. All that is yet needed, he concludes here, all that is yet needed is leadership to get the EU Constitution adopted. Agreed that the quality of leadership the founding fathers gave to America cannot be found in Europe today. While there are plenty of Europeans who want to make the EU a strong union, there are no leaders like George Washington that can ensure the government will not abuse its power. But the geopolitical forces shall enable the emergence of such a leader, and my discussions with leaders in Europe led me to believe that Chancellor Merkel is presumed to have such qualities. He goes on and finishes by saying, the difference in quality of leadership and the different foundations for this forming superpower will mean all the difference for this world, for everybody. This superpower will be radically different from America. It shall be more ruthless and more pragmatic and more difficult. And he said, I foresee it happening in the next 10 years. Very interesting, very astute observer. And I've never read anything like that anywhere. And he agrees, no, nobody seems to know, nobody seems to care. So, very interesting. And, you know, he uses the analogy of the formation of the United States, you know, to the formation of the United States of Europe, and the dual concerns, economic stability or instability and security. Exactly the same things. And, you know, brethren, this is the point. That was December 2009, okay, a month ago. A rare glimpse by a very intelligent and informed observer of the world scene. Now, notice this. In February 1934, 75 years ago, Mr. Armstrong warned of a coming sudden appearance of a resurrected Holy Roman Empire in Europe, a union of 10 nations under one government and one united military force. That was an informed and intelligent observation given by revelation from God to a man who could not possibly have known the outcome. He could not possibly, other than by himself. Back in 1934, human reasoning is not capable. Just not capable. This was prophetic revelation, not available outside of the spiritual realm. And even when Germany lay defeated, he still proclaimed the resurrection of Germany to dominate a European superpower. And people scoffed at that statement. They scoffed in disbelief. Puh, does he think he is saying things like that? It could never happen. You hear people say, well, you know, so many today never knew Mr. Armstrong. That's true. You hear that in some of the various churches. well, the people don't know Mr. Armstrong. We've got to do our work. And his teachings, they'll say, don't really matter. Well, I beg to differ with that. You know, I said to one individual, I never knew the Apostle Paul. I never knew the Apostle Paul. Did you? But his teachings matter. And they live on. And they live on. And so does Mr. Armstrong's teaching and writings live on. He's still teaching. It's still there. And, you know, referring to a 10-nation combine in Europe, Mr. Armstrong took his references from Revelation 17 and verse 12. I'll just turn there quickly as a reminder for you, but I know you know the scripture well. Revelation 17 and verse 12. He talks about, in verse 11, the beast, and then the 10 horns which you saw, verse 12, are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So, right now, the United States of Europe, or the European Union, has 27 nations. 27, but it says 10. Mr. Armstrong said 10. They've got 27 right now, and they're planning to add more. They're planning to add some more. So why specify 10? Well, we know that John chapter 10, verse 35, we won't turn there, but it says the scripture cannot be broken. Mr. Armstrong, you know, I guess he had it all wrong, did he? He got that wrong. He didn't realize it would be 27 plus. Is that it? God forgot to inform him? No. Here is a very plausible explanation, something you might not have heard of before. A very plausible explanation for what we see today. Something that Mr. Armstrong could not have seen at the time. He said he couldn't have seen it. There were too many things yet to happen. But here's the thing, the difference between a lot of individuals, a lot of human beings, and Mr. Armstrong, he believed the scripture. Doesn't matter whether it's 1934. It's going to happen. He just believed the scripture. Take a note of this. Have you ever wondered about the question of the 10 nations? Now they have 27 with more to come. That doesn't jive, does it? Doesn't fit. What are they going to do? Throw some of them out? No, they don't have to. They don't have to. And here's the reason why. In the European Union right now, they're presently, as we speak, considering a system that would be developed to group certain nation states together under one senior European commissioner. Okay? Obviously, the larger nations like France and Germany, Italy, Spain, they would stand alone, obviously. But a few smaller ones, you know, could be grouped under one administrator or one king. Okay? That ultimately will form the 10 kings referred to in Revelation 17. And the word kings means a sovereign or a foundation of power. A European commissioner has a lot of power. That is what's being considered to make it more manageable. It may have already been developed. I would imagine it already is basically there to put into place whenever it becomes, you know, a bit unmanageable the way it's becoming now. See, he was right. There's a plan. So keep an eye on this development. In fact, what you could do sometime, Google the European Union. Pull it up. And when you do, go to the Wikipedia site and click on it. And you'll see it says member states. And click on that. And it pulls up a map that shows where all the members are located. And you'll see right away with some of the smaller states, it would be so easy to group some of those together and to get the 10 out of it. It says 10 kings or 10 commissioners. And it will be 10. We make no doubt about that. Was Mr. Armstrong wrong? No. He believed God. And he couldn't see that that was going to take place. Obviously, he couldn't. Interesting, isn't it? Could you imagine how Mr. Armstrong would feel if he was alive today? Man, I could just hear him. And we're now looking for the 10th and last resurrection of the Roman Empire. the seventh head of this beast of Revelation 17, which is pictured, let's turn to Daniel chapter 2, pictured by the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Notice this, Daniel chapter 2, in verse 40, he says, "And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the strength shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." Verse 44, In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall not be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." So it's going to be a very uneasy union, so to speak. United for a while under certain conditions, and then it's going to have its major issues, obviously, as we know. And since these toes were on the 2 feet that represented Eastern and Western Europe, as we understand it, it appears there's no doubt that this final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire will include Eastern and Western European countries. Take a look at the map on Wikipedia and you'll see it. And since the EU now has its foot in both camps very securely. Okay? So thus the grouping of certain smaller nations under one administrator or under one king makes absolute perfect sense. Dr. Lamba does not understand that. He recognizes Germany would be the focal point, and we're going to talk about that. He had no idea, and he thought Mrs. Merkel might be the one. She's not the one. Back in October of 1967, Mr. Armstrong said, "At present, no single European currency is strong enough to replace the dollar in international trade, but an emergency situation could speed up the development of a single currency." Well, it happened. It happened. The euro is a fact of economic life. And the currency is dominated by who? Germany. Dominated by Germany. Here's an interesting fact you might not have thought about. How many of you are aware that Germany is a nuclear power? And you say, what? When did they explode a bomb in Bavaria recently? You know, they haven't exploded any. In fact, they haven't even made any bombs. Haven't made any. Then how can they possibly be a nuclear power? How is that possible? America has a large proportion of its atomic arsenal on German soil. Okay? Under American supervision. The question is, for how long? Back in 1968, that question was posed in a PT magazine. How long can America have control of that? You think Germany's going to give those weapons up if America said, "I want those all on the ship, we're going to take them back home"? They'd never get them out. As Mr. Armstrong said, and I'll talk about that in a moment, we've armed our enemy. Talk about Israel, a silly dove. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong wrote in 1948. And he said, "Even before the end of the war, the Nazis planned to go underground. They were going to lay low, and they're going to come forth when least expected and restore Germany to power and finally accomplish their plans in a World War III. As we restore Western Europe to economic prosperity and then to military power, a successor to Hitler will emerge. This individual will gain control of this power through a United States of Europe, which we are encouraging, and then we shall wake up too late to realize that we have restored our fascist enemy to power to destroy us." 1948, he said that. Look what's happened. Do we ridicule? Do we minimize? do we cut him short? No, you can't. It proves it. It's amazing what's taken place. Who would have taken him serious with those predictions, with Germany lying in shambles and defeated? People would say, logically, it's not possible. We're not talking human reason logic. We're talking God-inspired revelation and prophecies. You notice he made four specific statements. Three of which were, one, Nazi Germany would go underground, which they did. Germany would be restored to power and emerge on the world scene, which it has. And thirdly, they would rise to military power, which they have. It all happened in that very order. And the fourth statement is still waiting to happen. A successor to Hitler, who will emerge and gain that power and control it and use it against us. The Nazi underground siphoned off billions upon billions of dollars in gold they stole from the countries they conquered, fed it through banks, certain banks in Switzerland, down into South America and other countries, to finance their return. You know, Mr. Armstrong left no doubt that Germany would be the kingpin in this United States of Europe, and it is, without a doubt. In 1985, a year before his death, Mr. Armstrong said, "Every indication is that this advanced news that I've been preaching now for so long will very soon be current news." He was right. Very soon be current news. And it will completely stun the world. It will certainly stun the Western world. Yet the Plain Truth magazine, he goes on to finish up, he says, has reported this news for the past 51 years, using Bible prophecy as the foundation for these predictions. Astounding. So, a month ago, Dr. Lamba put forward an idea of a United States of Europe coming together using human reasoning and the analogy of the formation of the United States of America. That was a great article, the way he pieced it together. I thought, very logical. Whereas Mr. Armstrong, inspired by revelation from God, has been warning the world, especially our nations, for over 50 years of what this formation really means. Dr. Lamba didn't understand its ultimate implications of what it really meant, of this group coming together. And the warning was given, and the warning was ignored, and it is ignored today, even though his writings and his teachings still speak. Ignored at our peril. Before we talk about Germany, or more about Germany, and the Catholic Church, that connection, I want to mention something that you may not have considered at all in all of this, though some of you probably have, because you kind of wonder, and you'll understand what I mean in a moment. Another player that has implications in all of this, and that player, especially when looking at history, is the nation of France, or as we understand it, Reuben, the ancient name for today's French-speaking people. In 1968, the Plain Truth reported that after the departure of Charles de Gaulle, the Grand Charles, once he's gone, France will return to her traditional role of economic and political instability, and it would be her nationalistic German neighbors that would dominate the common market or in the Europe to come. And Reuben was the firstborn son of Jacob, who was the father of the 12 tribes of biblical Israel. Now, you remember the story. We've gone through it many times. The story when Jacob's sons conspired to kill their younger brother Joseph. Remember that one? We all know that story. Reuben didn't say, "You can't do that. I'm the older brother. I'm the firstborn. That can't be done." He didn't say that. He didn't say that at all. Reuben permitted the conspiracy to take place. In fact, he helped in the plan to remove his younger brother. But rather than kill him, he suggested he cast him into a pit in the wilderness and leave him there. Now, that's a nice compromise, isn't it? We're not going to kill him. We're going to put him in a pit and leave him. Okay. There's a compromise for you. It probably appeased his conscience. Okay, let's go to Genesis chapter 37. I want to pick up a bit of the story, go through something here. Genesis chapter 37. And there is a point here, believe it or not, that ties directly into what will take place in the future involving France. Okay, Genesis chapter 37, verse 12. When his fathers went to feed their father's flock, when his brother went to feed his father's flock in Shechem, Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock? Come, I want to send you to them. I want you to go to them. Go and see them." So he said, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring word back to me." So away he went. Verse 15, "Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' And so he said, 'I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding the flock.' And the man said, 'Well, they've departed. They're over there now. They've taken off over here.' So he went after them." Verse 18, "Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer's coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. Now we'll see what would become of his dreams.' But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of his hands and said, 'No, we can't kill him. We can't kill him.' And Reuben said to them, 'Shed no blood, but cast him into the pit which is in the wilderness, and don't lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him back out of their hands and bring him back to his father.' So that's what they did. They took the coat off, coat of many colors. Verse 24, and they took him and cast him into a pit. And then, of course, when Reuben wasn't around, the brothers, they followed his instructions, obviously. But then when Reuben wasn't around, they sold him into slavery. And now, at first glance, it might appear, well, listen, Reuben was trying to be a nice guy, a nice older brother. Hey, you can't kill him. After all, he proposed an alternative. Just drop him into a pit. But is that what's expected of the firstborn? Back in those days, if you were the firstborn, you had responsibilities. You had authority if you exercised it. You were to be respected and honored. You were going to inherit more blessings so forth within the family. But what did he do? He should have acted decisively. He should have acted the way his father would have and said, "We can't do that. And we're not going to do that. I'm going to take control of the situation. Control your anger. Don't be jealous of your brother," and so on. Move on. He didn't do that. He didn't do that. He made a compromise with his younger brothers. He should have stood up and been counted. But he lacked the courage to stand up and deal with his brothers. Notice verse 29. "And Reuben returned to the pit and saw Joseph was not there." He didn't even realize he'd been sold. He took off somewhere, maybe went for a coffee break somewhere. "Oh, I wonder what happened to our brother. Look down the pit, he's gone." So that just shows the degree of concern that he had. There is a striking parallel here between Reuben's behavior in the past and that of France today. Mr. Armstrong saw in advance that modern-day France, like Reuben, would show his weakness and compromise and betray his brother. In 1966, Mr. Armstrong said, "Reuben's modern descendants will be at the side of the prophesied beast of Revelation when the descendants of Joseph are taken captive." Did you ever wonder where France fitted into this? During the last two wars, France was at the side of her natural allies, the United States and Britain. The situation during the next war will be a whole lot different. France will no longer fight at the side of her former allies. She will turn against them. The descendants of Reuben will play their part in selling into slavery their brother Joseph, just like Reuben did some 3,700 years ago. Mr. Armstrong predicted that just as jealous Reuben anciently betrayed his brother, the same will be true in the end time, as France's involvement in the German-dominated United States of Europe will cause it to betray its brother, the United States and Britain. Did you ever wonder about France and her ultimate position in the United States of Europe? What? I don't understand that. I mean, aren't they our brothers? They are. Now you know the story. Now you know how it's going to play out. During the Second World War, the Vichy government in France made compromises with the Germans, didn't they? Didn't put up much of a struggle. How come Paris wasn't bombed into rubble? They wanted to save the City of Lights, their beautiful Paris. Don't understand. They cut a deal. They compromised. And they surrendered. Notice Genesis chapter 49 for a second. I'll show you something here. Genesis chapter 49. Before Jacob died, he told Reuben something very important that ties into what we're talking about here and the significance of what I'm saying and what Mr. Armstrong said. Genesis 49, verse 3. Verse 2, he gathered together the sons and said, "Listen to Israel, your father." Verse 3, "Reuben, you are my firstborn. You're my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power." Verse 4, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel." Unstable as water. You ever try to push water uphill? Use that term, you know, in various occasions. Unstable as water. That water-like instability has continued to this day. And for that reason, we will see the current trend grow even stronger. France will remain, as I think it was Mr. Armstrong put it this way, or I forget who the writer was, France will remain Europe's mistress. She will never be its master. Strong words. Strong words. But true. And revealed by God to Mr. Armstrong a long, long, long time ago. And it is all happening right now before our eyes. And the pieces are falling together. Note some of these stories in the Plain Truth magazine about this particular subject. I'm talking about Germany. December 1963. "So long as present German prosperity continues, the Nazi takeover will not be possible. But should any severe threat to that hard-won prosperity come, the picture will change violently in Germany." Remember, it was the aftermath of the disastrous stock market crash of 1924 and 1929 that fanned the flames of violence in Germany to pave the way for who? Hitler. History does repeat, and the Bible predicts a great trade war between the United States of America and the European Union. The financial collapse will bring great disorder for everyone. It's already taking place. It's already happening. Note this one, going back to 1955, from The Plain Truth. "In its final phase, to appear in our day, will merely be a restoration of that ancient Roman Empire, the United States of Europe. And we are helping to build the Frankenstein monster that is destined to destroy us." 1955. Provocative predictions? Upsetting to some people? Yes. Understood by no one? Most, yes. March 1962. "United within ancient boundaries of the Holy Roman Empire, united by the common spiritual bond of universal Catholicism, united geographically in the most productive industrial complex on earth, 10 nations in Europe will march onto the world scene as the greatest single force ever seen by man and is currently being assembled." 1964, Plain Truth magazine. "A united Germany will, with her former territories restored, is ready to emerge as the strongest nation on earth at the head of a revitalized Europe. This power colossus is then going to deal a death blow to the United States and Britain." the United States and Britain in Prophecy, 1980. The yoke of slavery without mercy is to be laid on the U.S. and Britain by the coming United States of Europe. The yoke of slavery without mercy. Won't be any compromises here. Its leaders talk about political union, which means also military union. So far, they have not been able to bring full political union, but that will be made possible by the good offices of the Vatican, who alone can be the symbol of unity to which they seek. I'm going to go through some of that a little bit, and you're going to see exactly what's taking place. He concluded this book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, by saying God's God's direction and authority, or through his direction and authority, I've laid the truth before you. To neglect it will be tragic beyond imagination. To heed it will bring blessings, happiness, and glory beyond description. So he understood. And he understood and he believed. That's why he could speak with such conviction. You listen to some of those World Tomorrow programs, his sermons, different things like that. Powerfully convicted and convinced. And he believed. We now have all the facts laid out in front of us. We've got the history and we've got the current events and we know what's coming. There's another fact unknown for the most part about the assault and future plans for world domination, and it involves Latin America. In 1957, you see some of these dates I'm throwing out here? 55, 34, you know, so on. 1957, long time ago. Plain Truth Magazine, 1957, reported that all Latin American countries will eventually join with the European revival of the old Roman Empire. Well, today, they're already strong trading partners. And for devoutly Catholic Europeans, Latin America is a home away from home. It really is. And here's something very interesting. With an office in every Latino country, the Vatican maintains a massive presence on that continent. They got it locked up tight. In no other geographic area does the Pope have such power and influence. The European Union and Latin America are more than just a trading duo. And we're talking right now about billions of euros of trade back and forth. He goes on to say they're more than just a trading duo. They are religious, commercial, and political partners. And Mr. Armstrong warned of this growing partnership and the dangers it holds as the United States, Canada, and Britain are left completely out of this trade agreement. And it's interesting, the European press has announced or mentioned recently in different dispatches, and also in North America, we hear it, that the American influence in Latin America is fast coming to an end. In fact, it was President Clinton back in his tenure. He wanted to form a trading agreement with Latin America and with South America. That never happened. It's never going to happen. Look at the hatred for the United States in Latin America right now. All being stirred up. Latin America, here's another interesting fact. Latin America, besides boasting agricultural and other resources, and they've got tremendously rich in minerals, they're all going back and forth to the European Union to run that machine. They're rich in resources. They also represent a population of over 500 million citizens. I think I mentioned that earlier. 500 million. The vast majority of which are firmly bound to Catholicism. Firmly bound. The Vatican is fully aware that more than half of the world's Catholics live in Latin America. You know, we can tend to forget, or we don't think about, or we don't know, or don't understand just how powerful and how influential the Vatican has proven to be in stabilizing the social and political climate in Latin America. Tremendous influence. And the fact is this, the European Union's corporate war machine, and it's a corporate war machine they're making right now, they're going to war with briefcases and billions of euros in the bank and with their far-reaching plans. And the powerful religious influence of the Vatican are so very quickly outsmarting, you know, America and Britain. While we're left way behind in the dust somewhere. People have no idea what's going on. We're being squeezed out. Well, here's another stunning development. Recently, in fact, while it was December the 2nd, 2009, just a short time ago, you might have heard about it, maybe you haven't. The German publication Der Spiegel, I like my German, Der Spiegel. Anyway, they published an article. This is a month ago. Listen to what they say. Germany's highest court has ruled that Sunday should be kept as a day of rest and has overturned a Berlin law easing restrictions on Sunday shopping. Most German newspapers on Wednesday greet the ruling, some with reasons for of religious and tradition, others out of a concern for workers' rights. Many visitors to Germany can find themselves standing outside a closed department store, perplexed to find that they cannot do a bit of shopping during the weekend trip. This is a result of Germany's long-held resistance to Sunday shopping, even in the face of growing consumerism. Now they're making it a law. Yet many of Germany's 16 states have already made some exceptions, allowing stores to open a few Sundays a year. And in Berlin, the city government has gone the furthest in chipping away at the ban on Sunday. In 2006, the German capital gave the green light for retailers to open on 10 Sundays a year, including the four preceding Christmas. However, Germany's constitutional court has now upheld a complaint made by the country's Catholic and Protestant churches, both of them, based on a clause in the German Constitution that Sunday should be a day of rest and spiritual elevation. The court on Tuesday decided in favor of the churches, saying that Sunday opening should not take place 4 weeks in a row. The ruling will not affect shopping this December, as 2009, but will come into force next year. Interesting, isn't it? What's happening over there? But it said the labor unions had joined the churches in their campaign to ring-fence Sunday as a day off for the nation. However, their focus was not on protecting the right to practice religion, but rather on protecting workers in the retail sector from having to work on Sundays, sometimes the only day they might get off to spend time with their families. And it goes on, a couple of other newspapers with their comments, basically saying, agreeing with it. But listen how they explain their reason for supporting it. This one publication said, the churches have argued correctly that employees in the retail sector are not given the possibility of organizing their Sundays according to Christian principles. Going to church, being involved in the community, singing and reading aloud. It is part of religious freedom to be able to do these things. The judges did not just endorse the division of time marked by Christianity, but also the necessity for this division. There is no ambiguity about this weekly rhythm. The people are social animals, and they're duty-bound and justified in dividing our time together. It is good to have free time together. It helps us to live as the social beings that we are. Another article said the ruling is humane. It's an act in favor of the public spirit. Those who regularly go shopping on Sundays today will have to work regularly on Sundays tomorrow. So let's close this day down altogether. And that's what they've done. So let's see, I'll read you one more here. Oh yeah, he says here, Sunday is a day off. It is a great gift. The treadmill is closed for 24 hours. The court has given relaxation, rest, and spiritual elevation precedence over the thirst for profit and the right to a consumer fix. It says, however, it made it clear in its ruling that Sunday was not just for those who wanted to practice their religion. It's also to play cards, go for a walk on Sunday, go for a walk, or simply laze around. After all, they conclude, even the strictest atheist needs the switching off that Sunday allows. I tell you. But you know, it's interesting that it talks in one of their articles, one of their constitutional in the German Constitution, that there shall be no state church. But you know what? The effect of the Sunday law is to institutionalize Roman Catholicism and its daughter churches as Germany's state religion. That's what they've done. That's what they've done. See all the nice things, well, we need the day off, and it's rich rest and relaxation. You can be with the family, da-da-da-da. Even atheists need a day off, you know, and they put the ring around it. Are you surprised to hear that? Are you shocked to hear that? Or does it awaken your senses a bit? Don't be shocked. But it's one more area where the screws are being tightened. Okay, the screws are being tightened. And Sabbath keepers will be very quickly recognized, if they're not already, and persecuted. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake. As the European Union and the Vatican enforces Sunday as a day of rest and worship. You know that the office called the Office of the Doctrine of the Faith, which is an office just below the Pope? And the man who used to run that office was Cardinal Ratzinger. Cardinal Ratzinger is Pope Benedict. And they have their people monitoring what the churches are saying. They know about the Worldwide Church of God back in those days, and East Armstrong, and the offshoots, and all that's taking place, and who's saying what. They know. And all of this reinforces and ties in, excuse me, with the necessity to be certain we are in a state of mind that leads us to get ourselves truly spiritually ready. Not to get ourselves positioned at the place of safety bus stop, if there is such a place and there isn't. That's God's call to those who qualify. It's not ours. Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. And let's see here. Right, verse 36. You know this one well. Does this verse tie into what we've just been going through? Watch therefore, and pray always that you be counted worthy to escape all these things which are to come, and stand before the Son of Man. Watch, that you may be counted worthy. Not that you are worthy. Or not that you think you're worthy. You're in the right organization, and if I follow what he says, I'm okay. No, not true. You've got to know where you stand. You've got to understand why you're where you are. You've got to understand why you're doing what you're doing. It doesn't matter what anybody else says. And watch here in this verse. Watch here means keep awake. And the word worthy, it means entirely deserving. Entirely deserving. Not just a little bit deserving. Look it up for yourself and see. We might understand the sequence of events by watching and staying awake. But are we entirely deserving? Back in October 1961, Mr. Armstrong said, "The Pope will step in as the supreme unifying authority, the only one that can finally unite the different nations of Europe." We've seen that come to pass. "The Vatican will exercise iron jurisdiction over both schools and religion, all to be turned over to the Roman Catholic Church. And Europe will go Roman Catholic. Protestantism will be absorbed into the Mother Church and totally abolished." That's what he said. And we're fast moving in that direction. And, you know, the problem with achieving unity with the Catholic Church is twofold, really. First, they must reconcile with the Eastern Orthodox Church. And second, a restoration to the Roman communion of all Protestantism. And those plans have been well underway for a long time. And they're working on them as we speak. Rome has a plan. Rome has a purpose. And they're accomplishing it. They've been about this process for many, many, many years. As early as 1896, Pope Leo XIII stated this. Now listen to what he said. This is 1896. It is sufficiently well known that no small share of our thoughts and of our care is devoted to the endeavor to bring back to the fold, placed under the guardianship of Jesus Christ, the chief pastor of souls, the sheep that have strayed. Bring back to the fold all the sheep that have strayed. All the Eastern Orthodox, all Protestantism. Back to the fold. Therefore, he goes on to say, therefore, the uppermost in our minds and chief consideration is unity. Unity according to Rome. It was in 1930, in the 1930s, Mr. Armstrong broke the news that unity would come, and many steps have been taken. Back in the 30s, he said that it's going to be unified. Catholicism will take over. Who would have believed that in the 30s? And you know, interfaith ecumenical services, prayer services and whatnot, were held in practically every major city in the United States by the end of the 70s. Pulpit switches by priests and ministers are becoming widespread and are now commonplace. The Plain Truth magazine, in February 1967, said, leading Protestant theologians are beginning to seriously question any need for a future Protestant movement. One Lutheran bishop said, if the Catholic Church of 450 years ago had looked as it does today, there never would have been a Reformation. What a change. Let's bring this more up to date and see what's taking place recently to confirm what Mr. Armstrong said. In June 1998, an article in the New York Times reported on a Vatican decision that's intended to resolve an issue that split the Western Christianity world nearly 500 years ago. The Vatican said yesterday that it would sign a declaration with the world's Lutherans, affirming they share a common understanding. They're hanging out the olive branch. And they're doing it ever so effectively. In 1999, the Daily Telegraph printed a report concerning a global summit conference between the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church. It was going to bring together bishops and archbishops from all over, and one of the principal areas of discussion would be the authority issue. Who is actually in charge? And you know who claims to be in charge. Pope does. And at the conclusion of the conference, it stated, we have moved significantly ever closer in our thinking. Anglicans are moving ever closer to Rome. Ever closer. The Anglican Communion is one of the last vestiges, if you will, of the old British Empire, observed the Wall Street Journal in an article back in October of last year. Interesting comment that they made. It's one of the last vestiges of the old British Empire was the Anglican Church. Now what's happening to it? Because it said that faith followed trade. And you planted the Anglican flag in all these far-reaching places around the world. And on October the 20th, last year, the Vatican had a press conference announcing that the Catholic Church would offer membership to all those who choose to convert, even allowing them to keep their Anglican practices, and the married clergy may be accepted as priests within a newly established Catholic Anglican community. Pardon me. And they offered the same thing to the Eastern Orthodox. The Eastern Orthodox are very, very high on tradition. They keep a lot of these old traditions. So the Roman Catholic Church is now bringing some of that back. Services in Latin. A number of the old traditions that they kept. This is to appeal to the Eastern Orthodox to bring them back into the fold. Something else very interesting about Britain that you might not have known about. There's a long-held tradition, talking about traditions, in Catholic circles that England is Mary's dowry. You ever heard that before? It holds that the Godhead gave England to Mary, the mother of Jesus, as a gift as the mother of the church. And now the Vatican wants to reclaim the dowry since Henry VIII severed relationships with Rome back in 1536. They don't forget, do they? Defections have taken place all over. And a group in the UK called the Traditional Anglican Communion, a group of many thousands of conservative Anglicans that broke away in 1990 to protest the liberalism within the Anglican Church, they said the process toward full unity with Rome is well underway. Well underway. It would be hard to overstate the impact of the Church of England on Britain's history. Already in the UK, more Catholics than Anglicans attend church services regularly. Catholicism will soon be the dominant religion in the UK. Closer than we think, as Catholicism moves to dominate religion. So the Vatican gets the Eastern Orthodox in line. They get the Lutherans and others in America in line. They've got the Anglicans in Europe, in the UK, starting to come into line. What does he have then? Virtually a large portion of the world will be Roman Catholic. That's what he's got. The domination of religion. Then it'll be the domination of Europe, economically and every other way. So what happens to Sabbath keepers? What happens to Sabbath keepers? What happens to those who observe the holy days of God? I want to read just quickly here over in Leviticus. And we read this during the holy days. I'm just going to read it again. What's going to happen to those who observe the holy days of God? They're not Jewish days, as somebody would like to say. Notice Leviticus 23, I'll read it for you, verse 2. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feast of the Lord which you shall proclaim. They're my feasts. They don't belong to the Jews. Yet they call, and will yet call, anyone observing these days as Judaizers. They will be persecuted. It's not necessarily going to be an easy time. We don't know what we have to face. Every time somebody finds out over the years that we kept the Sabbath or the holy days, whatever, first thing they say, oh, you're Jewish. No. No. John chapter 17. John chapter 17. Verse 8. For I have given to them the words which you have given me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I come forth from you. And they have believed that you sent me. I pray for them. I do not pray for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And all mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. Now I am no longer in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to you, Holy Father. Keep through your name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are one. That they may be one as we are one. And he says, keep them in your name. Keep, you know what it means? Keep in verse 11 means to guard from loss or injury by keeping an eye on them. But the coming church union, or unity, if you will, in Europe, will not bring peace that mankind desires. It's going to bring just the opposite. It's going to bring the mark of the beast. Notice Revelation chapter 13. Revelation 13. Yeah, they're going to say, finally, we've got unity. Isn't it wonderful? It might appear that way, but it won't be. Revelation 13, verse 16. Talking about the beast, Terry says, he causes all, both small and great, rich and free, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark of the or the number of the beast, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. And you know, the word mark here means a scratch or etching or a stamp as a badge or servitude. It will tell you when you can work and when you can't work. Mankind will then be in slavery to the beast's power. And Mr. Armstrong warned about it over and over and over for years. And the idea for some seems to be that since we will not be able to buy or sell without the mysterious mark, then I guess we should be really checking everything out and finding a way we can get it. Where does that logic, so-called, come from? It's amazing how people can get so confused so quickly. I heard of one individual that we've known for many years. Interesting fellow. We've known him for years. I'll say no more than that. Some idea, apparently, that there's no place of safety. Where's that come from? Some idea that there's not going to be a tribulation. What? So, boy, could you get off the mark real fast and forget the foundational teachings? Let's notice another scripture here. Revelation chapter 15. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on the earth. Verse 6. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and you have given them blood to drink, for it is their just due. Notice chapter 16. I read the wrong verse. My first mistake this year. It's only 16 days I'm allowed, you know. Revelation 15. I said, I wanted to go to 16. Then I saw, Revelation 15, verse 1. Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them the wrath of God is complete. Verse 6. And out of the temple came the seven angels having the seven plagues, clothed in pure white linen and having their chests girded with golden bands. Now, 16. I just read that. Notice verse 2. Anybody who says we should learn to go and find and develop and we should get this mark so we can buy and we can sell, we can prosper, we can do whatever. Look what it says in verse 2. So the first went and poured out this bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came upon the men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. Read the rest of the scriptures, folks, anybody who believes that. Mr. Armstrong called it the mark of the Roman Empire, of which the Roman Catholic Church is a large part of it, obviously. So you see, watching global conditions unfold is important to our well-being spiritually. Okay? Because it highlights the importance we must place on being ready. Luke chapter 21. Watching world conditions is not the only thing that we should do. It's part of the whole plan here that God has for us and the reason why we're here. Very significant part of it. Because when you piece it all together like we've done here today, and there's more you could put, you could talk for hours about these things. We won't have time for that. Luke chapter 21. We need to condition our minds for various serious difficulties yet to come. Verse 34. Luke 21, verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly, like it's going to come on so many. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Didn't Mr. Armstrong say that back in 1955, 1934, 1948, 1961, 1963, 67, and so on? All the way through. And the word heed here, it means to pay attention, to be cautious about, to apply yourself, be aware. That day is the period of destruction just ahead. It is saying, heed the warning and be prepared. it does not mean to build a bunker on the mountains somewhere, or in the mountains, stock up food and water and guns and ammunition. That's what many in the United States are doing. Building bunkers, buying ammunition, storing away, freeze-dried food and so on, preparing for what's to come. Matthew chapter 6 talks here about laying up or storing up some things. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 19. He says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroys and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." And in verse 20, lay up, those two words lay up, it means amass or reserve or keep in store. Our preparation is spiritual, isn't it, brethren? And God's challenge is to put our trust and confidence in Him, not in ourselves. Psalm 118. And verse 8. "It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man." Not just in the guy next door, the person sitting next to you, but you. Where's your confidence lie? Where's mine lie? Look at Jeremiah chapter 17 for a second. Jeremiah 17. Verse 5. "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes his flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. For he shall be like a shrub in the desert, and shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, in a salt land which is not inhabited. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, and whose hope is in the Lord." God led the Israelites for 40 years to teach them what? To teach them that man does not live by bread alone. Man does not live by bread alone. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 3. I'm just going to read it to you. Just so you know, it's not me. It's here. Verse 8. Verse 3, I'm sorry. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 3. "So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." Christ taught this principle as well. Let's go back to Matthew 6, something here. I want to just quickly look at Matthew 6 and verse 11. "Give us this day our daily bread." Give us this day what we need. Okay? In this verse, daily means whatever is needful. Whatever is needful. He does not tell us to hoard up great stockpiles of food, although it does not hurt to have some extra items in the cupboard in case of emergencies. Of course, we should do that. We have to exercise some common sense here as well. I know Mr. Bowles mentioned getting a little extra coal to have on hand. Good idea. Maybe having a few things in the cupboard somewhere that you might need, some extra rice or flour, maybe a few canned goods, a few things. Matches, candles, in case the power is going to be going out. Just use your common sense. But that's not where our strength is going to come from. That's not where our hope is. That's not our hope. That's just exercising common sense as well. Doing certain things you can do, but not relying on it to the point of distraction. Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Verse 24. He says, for whosoever or whoever desires to save his life is going to lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. The scriptures are very clear. We're limited to what we can do and accomplish on our own, right? We got to rely on God. We talked years ago about, you know, the kind of faith we're going to have. And you could hear, oh, I've got the faith. We can face whatever comes, not a problem. Yeah, as soon as the church came apart, they ran. Where's the confidence and faith that God's leading? We can't depend on ourselves. Now, we just went through some of the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong warned about for decades. And now we see it's unfolding. The beast's power about to be unleashed, the great whore ready to control the religion of the world, and the destruction that will soon occur. And when you understand what has taken place and what is yet to come, you soon realize there's no private bunker to retreat into. There's no cave we can find with no one around. There's no deserted island we can go to. There's no safe place to hide. That is why our focus and direction and faith must be in God. And He offers protection from the worst of the coming storms. That's our bunker. That's our safe haven. Doesn't mean we're not going to suffer. Doesn't mean we're not going to have to go through things. We are. Psalm 139. Verse 17. This is a very wonderful scripture here. He says, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great is the sum of them, God's thoughts toward you. And God's thoughts about you are to take care of you and to protect you and to provide for you. Do you believe that? You better. We're going to have to. Psalm 91. I shouldn't say you better. It doesn't sound right. I hope you do. Psalm 91. And verse 10. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For He will give His angels charge over you to keep you in your ways. God's thoughts about you are to take care of you, and to protect you, and to deliver you, and to be with you, and to sustain you, and to hold you up, and to give you your bread daily. Sustain you as you need it. That takes faith. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. I notice an example here of the kind of faith and the kind of trust that we must have and develop and live by. 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 1. It happened after this that the people of Moab, with the people of Ammon and others with them besides the Ammonites, came to battle against Jehoshaphat. Then some came and told Jehoshaphat, saying, a great multitude is coming against you from beyond the sea, from Syria, and which are in Hezron and Tamar. And Jehoshaphat, in verse 3, feared and set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. Verse 4. So Judah gathered together to ask help from the Lord, and from all the cities of Judah they came to seek the Lord. Jehoshaphat did exactly what God wants you and me to do when we're faced with difficulties and trials and troubles. Take it to Him. Take it to Him. And as he continued to ask God for help, he said in verse 6, and said, O Lord God of our fathers, are you not God in heaven? And do you not rule over all the nations, all the kingdom of the nations? And in your hands is there not power and might, so that no one is able to withstand you? And are you not our God who drove out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and gave it to the descendants of Abraham, your friend forever? Are you not that God? And they dwell in it and have built you a sanctuary in it for your people, saying, if disaster comes upon us, sword, judgment, pestilence, or famine, we will stand before this temple and in your presence, for your name is in this temple, and cry out to you in our affliction, and you will hear and save. And now here are the people of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and did not destroy them. Here they are, rewarding us by coming to throw us out of your possession, to which you have given us to inherit. Verse 12. O God, will you not judge them? For we have no power against this great multitude that is coming against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are upon you. That's quite a prayer, isn't it? There was no reason for these neighbors to be enemies. The king said, O God, will you not deal with them? We're helpless. Here's God's answer. Verse 14. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benadab. I get these names getting twisted around my tongue. Verse 15. And he said, listen, all you of Judah, and you inhabitants of Jerusalem, and you, King Jehoshaphat, thus says the Lord to you, do not be afraid nor dismayed because of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours but God's. And tomorrow, I want you to go down against them. Verse 17, you will not need to fight in this battle. Position yourselves, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. But don't be afraid, don't be dismayed, but go out toward them, go out against them, for the Lord is with you. So Jehoshaphat obeyed God's instruction. Notice verse 20. So they rose in the morning, got organized, went down, and of course you go through and read here what happened. Verse 24 shows God's deliverance. So when Judah came to a place overlooking the wilderness, they looked toward the multitude, this great horde that was coming against them, and there were their dead bodies fallen on the earth. No one had escaped. Not one. Not one. That's how God answered. You just go down there and stand against them and I'll take care of it, don't worry. The point I want you to remember is this. That your battles are not really yours, but God's. Okay? If you look to Him, they're His battles, not yours. Psalm chapter 34. Psalm 34. Verse 19. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. Afflictions here means distress, hurt, adversity, displeasure, or bad things. And deliver means to defend, to preserve, to rescue, to save. And God does not promise us an easy time during this life. Not at all. During this life in this world, or with what is yet to come, dark days await. But He does promise to fight our battles for us. And He promises to deliver us from every trouble and every affliction. Dark days are upon us. Let's keep watching and let's be sure we are getting prepared.